From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. 6 months after Katrina devastated the city of New Orleans, we went down there to survey the media landscape. We found that the aging infrastructure had been washed away, leaving little but opportunity. The TV stations were coping with a newfound hunger for news. The internet was becoming a crucial source for citizen-generated information. And there was a new and growing Spanish-speaking population rebuilding the city in need of a voice on the airwaves. New Orleans seemed to be a kind of media petri dish, a clean slate on which a new definition of urban media could be written. Now, on the eve of the second anniversary of the disaster, we decided to check in to see how the experiment was going. In April of 2006, Greg Meffert was New Orleans' chief technology officer trying to wire the city with free Wi-Fi.
You know, we have a scenario now where we can sit there and say, we're like a laboratory for everything new. I don't want leading edge, I want bleeding edge.
Meffert has since left, but Earthlink has stepped in with a two-tiered Wi-Fi arrangement which offers service to everyone but faster service for a price. Another innovation following the disaster was Spanish-language TV. During the storm, Ernesto Schweikert was begging for supplies, gasoline, to keep the generators going for the city's only Spanish-language radio station.
I was traveling to the different city halls asking for help, avoiding us completely. I mean, I felt so little.
But Schweikert told us in the spring of 2006 that he had dreams of building his own TV station. He got it, full power, digital ready, now running a feed from Telemundo. Meanwhile, the network affiliates, operating without Nielsen ratings for nearly 2 years, pressed on. That gave them the freedom to serve audiences in new ways without getting a ratings report card. Mason Granger, president and general manager of WDSU, NBC's affiliate in New Orleans, laid out that station's new commitment to news in the wake of the flood.
We didn't have an hour of news at noon before the hurricane, and we now have 2 hours of morning news on Saturdays and 3 hours of morning news on Sundays. We also do a local program from 10:30 to 11 every night, Monday through Friday, which is geared specifically to Hurricane Katrina-related information and issues.
Most of those programs have continued. David Walker is the TV critic for the Times-Picayune. 18 months ago, he told us that the media in New Orleans were like a jump ball. We asked him if they're still in the air, even after the Nielsens return this month.
Overall ratings for television news here are down compared with the July before the storm.
And yet there's no plans to discontinue some of that extended coverage.
No, for now. I think everybody's sort of waiting to see whether the Nielsen sample improves. I think there are some reservations by the broadcasters about the quality of the sample. I'm sure that everybody's poring over those numbers and trying to figure out what they mean.
Let's assume that those initial findings are borne out and that the audience for local TV news is actually shrinking. Is it possible that people are moving to online news sources?
I think that's one possibility. I also think, and this is just anecdotal, and actually, to be honest, it's sort of personal, I think there might be some news fatigue here that is compounded by just the daily frustration of existence here. And as important as it is for people to have information, there's not been an awful lot of good news coming on all those broadcasts. The news menu is driven by a lot of crime stories, and a lot of stories about the levees not being repaired, and stories about poisonous FEMA trailers. And I just think it's human nature at some point for people to grow some scar tissue. I should note that the restart of the professional football season may change that a lot. Another thing that will probably drive viewers back to those broadcasts is we're moving toward the peak of hurricane season.
As a TV critic, what's it been like to see the big-time anchors telling your story?
It's exhausting. The fear here splits two exactly opposite directions. One of the fears is that we'll be completely forgotten and that Anderson Cooper and Brian Williams will stop coming. And the fact is they haven't. Cooper's been here 20 times. Williams has been here 15 times to do live broadcasts from here. The other fear is that we'll be too well remembered. And by that, I mean every time Anderson Cooper does a setup in front of a flood-ruined house, it's potentially putting the message out there that all of the city is still in ruins. That's actually not the fact at all. The French Quarter and the Garden District and the sectors of town that tourists would visit, were they to come, are up and running.
Are they not coming?
What's not coming back are the weekend visitors, the people who would drive from Birmingham or Dallas to spend a few days eating and drinking and having fun. And that may be because of the mixed message that they're getting from the national media. There was a symposium of local hospitality industry leaders here early in the summer, and one of the panelists actually said he would smack Anderson Cooper if he could.
David Walker is the Times-Picayune TV critic. Lolis Eric Eli is a Metro columnist for the Times-Picayune. His beat now extends to covering the New Orleans diaspora, so he also sees the coverage from the outside in. Lolis, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure being back, Brooke.
Now, when we were there a year and a half ago, there was a lot of talk about the Times-Picayune becoming reinvigorated, more like a scrappy alternative paper, more responsive to all New Orleanians, not just some of them. Has that continued?
You know, it would be an overstatement to say that everybody loves us now. But the truth is, particularly in those days after the storm, folks found that the Times-Picayune was the best source of coverage because the national media often missed the kind of details that only local folks familiar with the area could provide them well. Additionally, despite the fact that the New York Times, National Public Radio, and several other news sources have done a good job of maintaining coverage of New Orleans, we have been the most consistent, and we've been the ones with the clearest local focus.
How has your job in particular changed since Katrina?
Well, I often ask myself when there will be a month in which the words Hurricane Katrina do not appear in my news column. I've taken to talking about the failure of the federal levees rather than Hurricane Katrina as a description of what happened on August 29th and the description of what caused the damage. But the truth is, either I'm talking about lawsuits that are pending against the Corps of Engineers, talking about attempts to get passage through Congress of a bill that would allow for the investigation of what happened on August 29th, 2005. I'm writing stories about people who are still being affected by the storm and its aftermath.
Let's examine this change of terminology. You say you don't refer to Hurricane Katrina anymore when referring to the disaster, but to the failure of the Army Corps of Engineers. This is a very, very important distinction, and it affects the whole narrative. Could you lay that out?
Well, there really are two narratives that people have gravitated toward in explaining what happened. One of them is that the people of New Orleans and our presumably corrupt politicians did a terrible job, and had we done a better job, then we would not have had the kind of problems we had. A corollary to that narrative is the idea that because of climate change and the poor positioning of New Orleans, there's really nothing that can be done to save the city, and the wisest thing is for all of us to move. If you look at the homes along the Mississippi Gulf Coast that were flattened as a result of the hurricane, you see the kind of damage that wind can do. If you look at what happened to the city of New Orleans, most of what you find is flood damage. Most of what you find is rising waters created by the failure of the flood walls designed to protect the city. The Corps of Engineers failed to follow even its own guidelines in the construction of the levees and flood walls that were supposed to protect the city.
As you've written, Hurricane Katrina wasn't supposed to be more than a Category 2 storm when it hit New Orleans. The levees and the flood walls were supposed to withstand a Category 3 storm. And the Corps acknowledged that their system was badly designed and badly built, a catastrophic failure, according to the commander of the Corps, Lieutenant General Carl Strzok.
The anecdote you relate about the admission of the Corps really gets at the heart of what our problem has been with media coverage. On the first day of hurricane season in 2006, the Corps releases this report that it itself had commissioned. And even in this sort of self-analysis, it admitted a whole lot of fundamental problems. Well, that was a big news story the day after it came out. But then the weekend news shows, it was dead. The agency responsible for levees and flood walls and dams and bridges all over the country, when they admit catastrophic error that results in the loss of human life, we think that's a big story. I can't figure out why the rest of the country doesn't find that to be that important. Don't even worry about us in New Orleans. Worry about your own flooding potential in Sacramento. worry about the other kinds of projects that endanger you in whatever bridge you have to cross, whatever dam you rely on for protection, and whatever part of the country you live in. I mean, a lot of our frustration is that the country seems to think we are a charity case. And our point is, well, wait, the United States Army Corps of Engineers is responsible for this devastation. If they drove a Mack truck through your living room, they wouldn't say, well, we're going to be nice and pay for it. You know, that ain't the way it works.
I know that you wrote in February, Mardi Gras time, that Hurricane Katrina seemed to confirm, perhaps forever, the sense that New Orleans is a foreign place attached to the United States by geography, but distant from it in every meaningful way. By that, do you mean that the rest of Americans seem to see this as foreign aid?
You can't forget about all of the folks who have come and are coming to New Orleans to help and who are indeed frustrated by the inaction of the federal government. But because of assumptions about New Orleanians being lackadaisical and party-hopping and so forth, there's a sense that we don't deserve more because we have not taken responsibility. And what that means is that when commentators, and for the most part they've been right-wing commentators, suggest that we are unworthy of assistance, that immediately fits into a conception about who and what we are. And therefore it becomes easy for the country to write us off.
What do you think hasn't been covered? What's the story that still isn't being told?
The great thing about American media is that most of the stories get told, but unless they are told repeatedly, unless you have one media outlet breaking a story and another one attempting to come up with a better day two story, the stories aren't important. I cannot think of anything that has not been reported, but it does not get analyzed, and it does not get viewed in the context of the national implications. So I suppose I would say that what has not happened is a discussion of the lessons to be learned for the rest of the country.
Lolas, thank you so much.
Brooke, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for your continued interest.
Lolas Eric Eli is a Metro columnist for the Times-Picayune. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ladies and gentlemen, Svengali is leaving the building. Well, that's just what I thought I'd call him. We can't just refer to Karl Rove as a political consultant turned presidential policy advisor. I mean, he was so much more. The president, a man famously afflicted with a mania for nicknames, had several for the man he called his dear friend, ranging from the architect to boy genius to turd blossom. Journalists picked up on those and repeated them and added some of their own.
Bush's brain.
The president's sidekick.
The boy genius.
Mastermind.
A lightning rod.
Or even
worst person in the world.
But his most notorious sobriquet emerged late in his tenure when he participated in a rap composed and performed by journalists at the 2007 Radio TV Correspondents' Dinner.
He's a man, he's a treasure trove. But tell me, what is your name?
I'm MC Rove.
That's right. He can't be beat because he's so white from his head to his feet. But he will.
I don't know that I can prove it, but I have a very strong feeling that that's unconstitutional.
David Letterman.
I'm going to look into it, but I'm telling you, one way or the other, that's not right.
He's not alone, and in fact, press critics, and everybody is one, increasingly slam such events as blatant suck-up sessions. But to shower with praise, even ironically, the most powerful political tactician in town seems particularly egregious, and if pressed, Rove would probably agree it's not tactical. He'd kick reporters in public, but kiss the chosen ones in private. By kiss, I mean leak, and by chosen, I mean Robert Novak.
Howard Rove has been a source since he was a young fellow as a consultant in Austin, Texas, I guess in the 1970s.
Did you name him in any of these columns?
No, but everybody knew he was my source. That was known. What was not known was that he was a confirming source on the Valerie Plame story. That information came out through him and his lawyer.
Rove leaked throughout his career, especially to Novak. Indeed, he was fired for leaking to Novak when he worked in the 1980 Reagan campaign. And of course, he was a confirming leak in the affair of former CIA operative Valerie Plame, both to Novak and to a Newsweek reporter, which Rove denied under oath because of, quote, memory problems. The Reagan campaign leak, essentially a knock at an opponent, is instructive, if only because Rove is most famous as a bare-knuckled campaigner. Reporters who spent years covering the races he ran in Texas began to spot patterns. They called them the mark of Rove. Not just tactical leaks, but whisper campaigns. One that hinted that Texas Governor Ann Richards might be a lesbian, or that maybe John McCain had been rendered a bit wacky by his experience as a POW, or that McCain had a black love child. Rove denied it.
And the idea that I would have, or that anybody in the Bush campaign would have anything to do with spreading a scurrilous rumor, either I'm a genius or I'm an idiot. Only an idiot would spread trash like that.
But he was responsible for some of the most brutally effective campaigns in history, and Washington-based journalists and pundits loved him for it. He knew things they didn't, crunched numbers in ways they didn't think they could crunch. Here he is explaining math to NPR's Robert Siegel before the 2006 midterms, disastrous for the Republicans.
I'm looking at all of these, Robert, and adding them up, and I add up to a Republican Senate and a Republican House. You may end up with a different math, but you're entitled to your math. I'm entitled to the math.
Well, I don't know if we're entitled to our different math, but you're certainly entitled to your
math.
Analysis.
I said the math.
Doing the dance, the car road dance, dancing and talking and dancing.
In a serendipitously timed article on Rove in the current Atlantic, Joshua Green asks, why did so many people get Rove wrong? And he answers, one reason is that Rove excelled at winning elections, which is, finally, how Washington keeps score. Journalists, Green wrote, tend to admire tactics above all else.
There are practitioners in politics who hold that voters are dumb, ill-informed, and easily misled.
Karl Rove.
That voters can be manipulated by a clever ad or a smart line. Some argue political professionals are ruining American politics. It's odd to me that most of these critics are journalists and columnists. Perhaps they don't like sharing the field of play.
He is the sidekick to the president. He's going way above. Tell me, what is your name? MC Rove.
Karl Rove said President George W. Bush was one of history's consequential presidents.
And this president and presidents like those before him, Ronald Reagan in particular, we're shaping history, not trying to stop it.
No longer shaping history and unable to stop it, The Atlantic's Joshua Green suggests he'll now be focused on rewriting it.
Day to day, you know that I wonder where is Karl Rove. He's got this swell fall guy. So Karl, where'd you go? New Orleans is going great. Iraq is awesome. So where is my turd blossom?
The 2008 presidential election will be the first since 1952 without a sitting president or vice president on the ballot, which may explain why candidates are in the midst of one of the most protracted job interviews in campaign history. But it's not enough to simply tout your resume and bullet point your plan for the future of the country. According to Paul Waldman of the liberal media watchdog group Media Matters for America, if you want to be president, you have to have a story to tell. And Waldman believes the best presidential stories come in three parts.
Well, what the three-part narrative does is it tells voters first what's wrong with the country or wrong with the government. The second part is what the fix is for that problem and what the country will look like after the problem is solved. And the third and most important part is why that candidate and only that candidate is the one who can get us there.
You wrote that Jimmy Carter, though widely viewed as a failed president, was an adept presidential candidate, at least in 76. What did his three-part narrative sound like?
Well, the first part was obvious. We were coming out of Watergate, and the big issue was corruption in Washington. Carter defined that as the problem, and then what he did in his campaign was he campaigned not wearing a suit or a tie. His ads showed him in these kind of pastoral settings out in what seemed to be a park or the woods, and he said he would never lie to the public. And his campaign slogan was, a government as good as its people.
I'm a Southerner, and I'm proud of a heritage that shows concern for the working men and women who are the backbone of our great nation. These are the people forgotten by the present administration. When I'm elected president, that will change.
Now, if you fast forward 4 years later, the economy wasn't going well. We were being held hostage in Iran. And Reagan very skillfully defined himself as the one who could cure all of those ills that he really defined as an illness of the spirit. What Reagan said was that we could bring America back to this place of glory.
What he literally said was, it's mourning in America.
Well, the Mourning in America theme actually came 4 years later in 1984, which people generally look back on now as one of the most skillful campaigns ever. And what we see with successful incumbents, what Reagan did is define the good times as being tenuous. And so people remember those Mourning America ads, you know, people raising a flag, kids riding down the street, a couple going into their first new home.
It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than 4 short years ago?
The message was that there was a danger, the times were good, and if we made the wrong choice, that we would fall back into the terrible times of 4 years before.
Well, what was the third part of Reagan's story? What made him the man for the job?
Really successful presidential candidates like Reagan, they understand that the vote is an expression of who we are, our own identity as voters. So when people cast their ballots for Reagan, they wanted to see themselves as patriotic and optimistic and strong and willing to overcome these problems. Back, let's say, in 1968, when people voted for Richard Nixon, they were proclaiming their own membership in the silent majority, that group of Americans who didn't like the hippies and was concerned about crime and unrest in the cities. Nixon framed that vote as you proclaiming your own identity in that group of Americans.
So what you basically said is that these votes are symbolic as much as they are practical.
Absolutely. Democrats in particular in the last few years have been laboring under the misconception that politics is about issues. Politics is not about issues. Politics is about identity. It's about who candidates are and who we are as Americans. Just to get back to Reagan for a second, he had this kind of citizen hero shout out where they bring in some ordinary American who had done something heroic and put him in the audience of the State of the Union. Reagan was the first one to do that.
Just 2 weeks ago, in the midst of a terrible tragedy on the Potomac, we saw again the spirit of American heroism at its finest. The heroism of dedicated rescue workers saving crash victims from icy waters. And we saw the heroism of one of our young government employees, Lenny Skutnik, who, when he saw a woman lose her grip on the helicopter line, dived into the water and dragged her to safety.
The message was, for Reagan, that we as ordinary Americans are the heroes of our story. People who voted for him could see themselves as heroes who just hadn't had the opportunity yet.
I hear echoes of that in both of Bush's campaigns, the current George W. Bush, a sense that we were heroes by dint of being American. I mean, even after 9/11, he never asked us to do much but shop.
That's right, although I would say that he was the real hero of his reelection campaign. But even in 2000, when he first ran for president, George Bush employed this three-part narrative very skillfully, too. He said that he wasn't part of the bickering that had taken place over the impeachment scandal, and because he was a devout person and an honest person full of integrity, he would bring dignity back to the Oval Office and get us passed with his compassionate, conservative, post-ideological ideology. He would get us past all those arguments.
I think there's a lot of cynicism today in America because of broken promises. I believe most people expect the best out of elected officials, and when elected officials disappoint them, it creates a cynical environment.
And so people who wanted to cleanse the country of all the bitterness and rancor of the 1990s could see in him a vehicle through which they could get that accomplished.
So let's go now to the current field of candidates. I know that among all the candidates that you've considered, you think Barack Obama has had the best story to tell. And it really sounds like the story you described for George W. Bush is the one that Obama's telling.
It's slightly updated. First of all, he's only 45 years old. That means that alone among the candidates, he is not a baby boomer. He was not old enough in the 60s to have burned his draft card. He's neither a hippie nor a square. He's not on either side of those arguments.
When I talk about holding America up to its ideals,
of opportunity and equality. This is not just the rhetoric of a campaign for me. It's been the cause of my life, and it's a cause that I will work for each and every day as President of the United States on behalf of all people, not just some people, but all people.
Also, people still feel that whatever the persistence of racism is and how much people acknowledge it, they would like to transcend race. And Obama, of course, is a multiracial person. And so he is embodying the things that we want the country to be in that sense.
And so his vote has that feel-good factor that Reagan's vote had.
Exactly. And almost none of the other candidates running this time have constructed that kind of a narrative. The one who comes closest is John Edwards. He has this narrative about the two Americas, saying that the rich have kind of left everyone else behind.
But I want to be clear, when I'm talking about two Americas, I'm not just talking about the difference between the rich and the poor. I'm talking about the very rich and everybody else. That's the two Americas.
If you vote for him, it's a vote, kind of an affirmation of that story.
But you think Edwards' story is vulnerable. How come?
It's vulnerable because there seems to be a real antipathy toward Edwards among the press corps. The prevailing feeling, if you want to make an inference from the way he gets covered, seems to be that he's a phony. Recently, he went on a poverty tour. They can write the lead of their story on that event by saying, in an effort to overcome the problems that he's had with his $400 haircut and his 28,000 square foot house,
right,
John Edwards embarked on a poverty tour. At that YouTube debate, each candidate had the opportunity to put up their own video. Edwards' video was set to the tune of Hair from the Broadway show.
Give me a head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shiny.
What he seemed to be doing was, first of all, picking a fight with the press, which Republicans do all the time, but Democrats don't do very often, and trying to change the associations that people had with the $400 haircut. And if every time a reporter drops in the line about the $400 haircut into a John Edwards story, what it evokes in voters' minds is, oh, why are they picking on him? Why can't they write about something substantive? Then he will have been successful in beating that back.
So let's talk about some other candidates. A Republican, Mitt Romney.
Romney has a message that's kind of out of the 1980s.
It is time to cut out the mountains of waste and inefficiency and duplication in the federal government. I've done that in business. I've done it in the Olympics. I've done it in Massachusetts. And frankly, I can't wait to get my hands on Washington.
His persona that he's trying to get across is that he's this sort of can-do business leader who will come in and clean everything up. I don't know how compelling it is because it's hard when you want to make experience the basis of the message that you have as opposed to something that's kind of more fundamental about who you are. And this is the problem that some other candidates have too. For instance, Hillary Clinton. When she gets asked why she's the best candidate or why she's running for president, what she says is that she has the most experience.
I've been fighting for more than 35 years on behalf of poor people and children and women and families. I worked in Arkansas with my friends from Arkansas to reform our schools and to reform rural health care. I have worked across our state in New York to bring economic opportunities to our smallest villages and help our farmers.
Now, that's not a story. That's more a description of a resume. If you ask people, if you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton, what does that say about you? I'm not sure what the answer is.
Let's talk about Rudolph Giuliani. Quickly, his narrative has to do with helping to clean up New York and being America's mayor during 9/11. Now, what is the job he's going to clean up and why is he the man to do it?
You know, we talked about what a vote for a particular candidate says about me. A vote for Rudy Giuliani seems to say, I'm scared. When you listen to him talk on the stump, it's really apocalyptic that the terrorists are packing up their boats to come over to get us, and if we don't elect somebody who is strong and will keep fighting them, we're all going to die.
The lesson that I learned coming out of September 11, 2001 is never ever again will this country be on defense waiting for them to attack us. The United States of America will be on offense.
There was a headline in the satirical newspaper The Onion that said Rudolph Giuliani to run for president of 9/11.
Exactly.
And he got mocked for this. But it really has been extraordinary. There was a story in New York Magazine where the reporter was with him at an agricultural event in California. And, you know, he comes from New York. What does he know about agriculture? And he said, well, I don't know a lot about agriculture, but I learned the importance of agriculture on September 11th.
because we are all connected and we need food and something like that. But it just goes to show the lengths to which he was going, at least in the early days, to shoehorn September 11th into any discussion that, you know, in the face of danger, he helps us get through it.
Paul, one last question. Come election time, you're going to vote, presumably for the candidate with the best platform, not for the one with the best story, right?
That's true.
Is that because you're smarter than most Americans? Let's just be out there on the record. You're suggesting that people are more influenced by what their candidate represents symbolically than what they're saying practically in a program, that bullet points really don't hold the day. So I'm asking, is that true of you?
I think from my own choice, which I really haven't made firmly yet, I'll say, it's a combination of both of those things. Even for people who are political junkies, a lot of your decision ends up being on a kind of gut feeling. How am I going to feel when I pull that lever for them?
Paul, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. Coming up, a reporter who lost his religion on the religion beat. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. The debate over whether the personal beliefs of journalists affect their reporting, the objectivity debate, is a hardy perennial. But we rarely consider the reverse scenario. What happens when the work of reporters takes a toll on their personal beliefs? That's what happened to LA Times religion reporter Bill Lobdell. A born-again Christian, Bill lobbied hard for the religion beat at the LA Times. He eventually got his wish and became their religion reporter, only to lose his faith in the church and in God in the process. Bill says he turned to religion at a difficult time in his life. His marriage was on shaky ground. He just had his first child. He was looking for guidance, and on the advice of a friend, he went to church.
I fell in love with the church, God, everything else. Ended up going on a religious retreat. And at the end of that weekend, I felt God actually coming into my heart. I actually felt it. It seemed like it was a tangible thing. And I felt that I'd become a born-again Christian.
And was it at that point that you began to feel that the mainstream media coverage of religion was inadequate or basically wrongheaded?
It was. I thought oftentimes that newspapers and the media in general treated religion like a freak show. Journalists didn't think people were serious about their faith. And if they were serious about their faith, there's something very odd about them.
You were moved to try and convince your editors at the LA Times to give you a shot at the religion beat. And by 2002, you were covering the Catholic Church sex abuse stories around the country. You were going to church twice a week, and you were taking conversion classes in order to become a Catholic. What was that like?
That was very tough. I interviewed literally hundreds of victims. I interviewed lying bishops. I interviewed their lawyers, and it was really tough to reconcile this church that I saw as being something great and something that I wanted to enter and what I was seeing in my day-to-day work.
I know that one of your spiritual mentors told you that, look, this isn't about the church. This is about flawed human beings. You can still maintain your faith in the church, but you didn't think so.
Well, they said, you know, keep your eyes on the man on the cross, not the person behind the altar. And that's true. And I get that this is human failing. But the problem is, for me, I thought the church and any religious institution should be somehow better than Enron or a corrupt government. In some ways, it was worse.
So on Good Friday in 2002, after a year of conversion courses, you decided not to convert to Catholicism. But even after that, even after you stopped going to church, Bill, you still maintained a belief in God. Eventually, that was also lost. What happened?
I think my mind caught up with my heart. My faith had been chipped away at through stories and through what I saw. It's something that I really, really didn't want to give up. And so I held on to it. I tried some spiritual counseling. I did try to double down on my prayer life. None of it worked. The final blow came in a Portland courtroom. It was a hearing for a mother whose child was sick. She was trying to get more child support from the child's dad, who happened to be a Catholic priest. And she really lived a miserable life. She lived in a friend's basement for free. They got food from the food bank. And the priest was on the stand. He had a great lawyer, just the sharpest attorney. She couldn't afford one, so it was this mom, basically, against this high-priced lawyer. And his defense was, I took a vow of poverty, and I don't have any money to give. You know, I sat there and watched the Catholic Church pay for these high-priced lawyers so their priests could get out of paying child support. I saw the mom being crushed by this machine, and I sat there in the courtroom, and I wasn't surprised. I kind of lost that sense of outrage even. And at that point, I realized I just don't believe any of this stuff anymore. And I called my wife on the cell phone and just said, I need to get off this religion beat. It's over.
You wrote at the end of the piece, I saw now that belief in God, no matter how grounded, requires at some point a leap of faith. Either you have the gift of faith or you don't. So, Bill, do you think you would have lost your faith if you hadn't been reporting on religion?
I don't know. I think that I was in a unique position. I saw things other people don't really see. I used to think faith was a choice. It's like going down a street. You're going to go this street or that street. Which way are you going to pick? But for me, it became very clear internally. I just didn't believe. It was like a light switch went off. And I could fake it, but it wasn't there anymore.
Do you wish you'd never asked for the beat?
No, I'm glad. It's been a tough road, but I'm glad I, unless I go to hell when I die, I'm glad that...
Wait a minute, I thought you don't believe in that stuff anymore.
Well, you know, it's always, it'd be nice to hedge on the other side, you know, if you're going to hedge one way or another. But no, I don't believe in that stuff anymore. I just hope to God, that's the baddest thing, but I hope to God I'm right.
It's a hard habit to break, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
What's your beat now?
I did a radical change. It's called Living Vicariously in L.A., where it's sort of a first-person accounts of as a paparazzo, for example, or as a pastor at a Unitarian church giving a sermon. Actually, I got to be a Botox patient. I got Botox. it's a fun, needed change of pace for me.
A real relief?
It's a real relief. I think part of me feels like I've kind of given up, and so that doesn't feel good. But the other part of me feels a huge relief off my shoulders.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Lobdell is a reporter at the LA Times. After years of being ignored or hidden, atheists have begun to speak out, and they're making an impression, especially on the book world. The latest atheist blockbuster is Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great. But Hitchens' path to bestsellerdom was blazed in part by such incendiary writers as Sam Harris, author of Letter to a Christian Nation. When he wrote that since 20% of all recognized pregnancies end in miscarriage, God is, quote, the most prolific abortionist of all, he made a lot of people very angry. In the following piece, which ran in December, we noted that Harris is one of the so-called new atheists, as is Oxford scientist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion. They wield logic like a bludgeon, so much so that even Comedy Central's South Park, a series that has savaged Scientology, Christian fundamentalism, and the Mormons, got out the knives.
Let us not forget the great Richard Dawkins, who finally freed the world of religion long ago. Dawkins knew that logic and reason were the way of the future. But it wasn't until he met his beautiful wife that he learned using logic and reason isn't enough. You have to be a dick to everyone who doesn't think like you.
Sam Harris concedes he's on a mission to make moderates less moderate.
Because moderates insist that we respect their religious faith, we can't criticize
the role that religious faith is playing in dividing people.
And Harris says moderates are mistaken if they believe the wall between church and state can protect us from extremists. They've already scaled it.
If you think the creator of the universe is letting people fly planes into our buildings because we are tolerating gay marriage, or he's whipping up hurricanes in the Gulf because we're tolerating gay marriage, you have to try to legislate against gay marriage. And if you think the creator of the universe is going to be scandalized by the mere depiction of Muhammad, you have to take to the streets and start rioting. There's nothing intolerant or mean or fundamentalist or dogmatic about opposing this kind of delusion.
Real life differs from culture wars in the media.
Gary Wolfe wrote about the New Atheists in Wired magazine. He says that the blunt tactics used by the New Atheists cannot be applied to personal arguments over faith, where delicate family and work relationships might hang in the balance. He says the polemics of New Atheism can be just as nasty as the fundamentalists.
So while I don't accuse the atheists of being fundamentalists, the rhetoric they use resonates with the religious rhetoric that controls much of our cultural debate today.
Sam Harris.
There's nothing fundamentalist about rejecting the claim that the universe is 6,000 years old.
Yes, there is, says Christian Coalition founder Pat Robertson, speaking on the 700 Club.
What we've got to recognize just there in this case is that the evolutionists worship atheism. I mean, that's their religion. So this is an establishment of religion contrary to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
If, in fact, atheism were a religion, it might get more respect.
That label evokes a strong negative response in American life.
Penny Edgell is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota. In 2003, she and her colleagues, Doug Hartman and Joe Gratice, conducted a national poll to determine which of 10 ethnic and religious groups the average American would least like their children to marry.
We had included atheists on the list as a group that we expected would have low levels of disapproval. And therefore, we thought, well, that will be a good yardstick against which to measure other kinds of attitudes. We were really very surprised.
Atheists were deemed the least desirable. Muslims did better in 2003, and gays and lesbians, maybe because most respondents had at least seen one or two. But research suggests avowed atheists are few and far between.
Just do the numbers, right? If they're only 7% of the American population, odds are most people don't know one.
People fear what they don't know, and so they tend to be suspicious of the absence of a presence in the lives of atheists.
It is religion, having a faith, that makes people in the American context seem trustworthy, like good citizens and good neighbors. So if you don't have that as a moral boundary, you're an outsider, an other, and perhaps a dangerous other.
We're all familiar with phrases like, you know, I have to say it, Jews are cheap, Italians are in the mafia, blacks are on welfare, gays are promiscuous, and atheists are immoral.
Ellen Johnson is the president of American Atheists, but the phrase she hates most of all goes a little something like this.
Perhaps you've heard the expression, there are no atheists in foxholes.
Wartime, there are no atheists in foxholes.
To amend the old saying about foxholes, there are no atheists driving trucks in Iraq.
That was CBS's Katie Couric and Bob Schieffer and NPR's John Burnett. Those were just the three we got tape of. News people say it all the time. Ellen Johnson.
It's demeaning to atheists. It's saying that under very dire circumstances or frightening situations, atheists will stop being atheists. They will start to be leaving. And this is really just a wish on the part of the religious because it's not based in fact.
I thought it was a good line for the tape.
NPR's John Burnett.
And I didn't realize that it was so offensive to atheists. And I learned that in spades after the story came out. They spammed me for weeks with email saying, we're outraged. So now I know.
And did you sort of see their point?
I do see their point. I literally hadn't thought about it before. And frankly, I will think twice about using the phrase again.
So if the news media aren't sensitive to atheists, Hollywood must be, right? I mean, the political right says it's so gay and liberal and irreligious.
Faith. That's another word for ignorance, isn't it?
That's Dr. Gregory House, a brilliant if antisocial diagnostician and the main character in the Fox medical drama, House. He's also an atheist. In a recent episode, House comes up against a teenaged faith healer who seems to be curing a patient with terminal cancer.
Fear for the human race. The teenager claims to be the voice of God, and people with advanced degrees are listening.
In a hospital staff lounge, a colleague posts a scoreboard with two columns, House versus God. Whenever House can't explain a medical result, says David Shore, creator of the series,
God got a check mark. When House explains something, House got a check mark.
At the end of the show, on that little tally board, you left it at a draw.
Yes.
But I think you were actually pulling your punches a little there, weren't you?
I hope not. Maybe. I do it sometimes. I don't know.
Yes, he does, because House actually found a medical explanation for everything the faith healer claimed to be doing through God. Hollywood usually pulls its punches on atheism. Mostly, TV atheists are lost souls, like Jen in the teenage drama Dawson's Creek that ran from 1998 to 2003. Here was Jen in the series premiere.
You know, I don't do real well with church and the Bible and this prayer stuff.
I beg your pardon?
I don't covet a religious God. Grams, I'm an atheist.
And here she is in the series finale, terminally ill, taping a farewell message to her baby daughter.
I've never really believed in God, but I hope that you are able to believe in God. Because the thing that I've come to realize, sweetheart, is that it just doesn't matter if God exists or not. The important thing for you to believe in something.
There's very few openly atheistic people on television, and I find that a little surprising.
House creator and writer David Shore.
Atheists to me fall in the same category to some extent as lawyers, in the sense that people hate them in general, but like their own. They know House, they like House. They don't care he's an atheist, I don't think.
You know, I get it if people are just looking for a way to fill the holes, but they want the holes. They want to live in the holes. And they go nuts when someone else pours dirt in their holes. Climb out of your holes, people!
I like that one. I like that one a lot.
But even Shore is inclined to believe there are no atheists in foxholes, or at least hospitals.
To ignore issues of faith is to ignore a pretty fundamental part of all people's lives when they're in the hospital facing death. I'm not saying all people find God, but they certainly do ask those questions.
What's an atheist to do? American Atheist President Ellen Johnson says they have to organize.
Until the atheists start voting their atheism and be identified as a voting bloc in America, the politicians aren't going to listen to us. We're not going to have any influence in the public schools. We're not going to have any influence in the media or anywhere else.
But even she concedes that organizing atheists is like herding cats. Sam Harris says the only way to win is to keep up the pressure until religious tolerance is no longer tolerated.
I think the criticism of irrationality just has to come from 100 sides all at once in the entertainment community. I mean, you'll just have people making jokes that are funny enough and true enough so as to put religious certainty in a bad light.
We know atheists are brave.
Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert.
They're not afraid to go to hell and be tortured by Satan for all eternity, which is what's going to happen.
One day, someone in the White House press corps will hear the President of the United States express some certainty about being in dialogue with the creator of the universe, and he or she will ask a question which should be on everybody's mind. How is this any different from thinking you're in dialogue with Zeus?
That day is far off. But Harris has a great deal of faith in his fellow man.
I'm hopeful that journalists and people in the entertainment industry are waiting for the permission to express their doubts. And I think that permission is coming. I mean, I'm trying to do what I can to engineer it in my hard-headed and boorish way. And I feel just from the contacts I have in both industries that there's a profound sense of relief that comes with hearing somebody call a spade a spade.
Was that what Stephen Colbert was doing when he addressed an audience of Hollywood elite at the Emmys this year?
Good evening, godless sodomites.
Harris may have no tolerance for the gospel, but as an atheist trying to enlist Hollywood in his crusade, Colbert's greeting has to sound like some kind of good news.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Wolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer, with help from Rob Christensen. We also had help from Andrea Ambro and Madeline Ellish. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Bob will be back next week.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.